Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The heir of Slytherin. He was standing at the end of a very long, dimly lit chamber. Towering stone pillars, entwined with more carved serpents, rose to support a ceiling lost in darkness, casting long black shadows through the odd greenish gloom that filled the place. I'm Vanessa Zoltan.
And I'm Matt Potts.
And this is Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. Matt, this week we are talking about compassion and you're telling us a story.
That's right. I am. Yeah. My son, Danny, who just turned 8 years old, is a very sensitive child. He's actually very empathetic. He cares a lot about other people's feelings, and he's very snuggly and kind and considerate. And when we used to drive up to the city, we lived outside the city, and we'd drive up sometimes to visit campus or to visit you, Vanessa, or to visit friends up here. We'd sort of invariably, like, at an intersection, we'd see a person asking for money with a sign that says, you know, I need money. And I think when Danny couldn't read, he just sort of said, well, here's a guy standing there, whatever, right? And then he acquired the ability to read what their request said. And he became very concerned if we drove past these folks, right? And we would try to have conversations with him about, like, you know, what's going on. And you know, you can't really explain the structural violence that makes homelessness possible and the lack of support for mental illness and addiction. It's hard to explain to a 4-year-old, right? Impossible to explain, really. And in some ways, those are probably just rationalizations, because Danny would always just kind of whimper. Like, we'd drive by somebody and Danny just kind of, in the back seat, right? Like, for blocks. And you know, one time Clint was just like, Danny, do you want me to turn around and go, yes, please, right? So this is how it is with Danny. Now we've moved to the city and we walk through Harvard Square, and there are always folks, often the same folks, familiar faces, folks who are asking for money and asking for help on the sidewalk in Harvard Square. And just before Thanksgiving, this is a story I'm relaying from Colette because she told me this, but just before Thanksgiving, after the last day of school, kind of as a celebration, they went to a local bakery in the square to get some treats and kind of celebrate the end of the transition to their new schools. And they walked by two people who were asking for money on the sidewalk. And Danny this time took a slightly different tack. He was not whimpery. He was sort of defiant. He's like, Mommy, why aren't you giving them money? And Colette was like, you know, a lot of grownups don't carry cash anymore, right? And Colette honestly said, you know, I don't have any money. And he's like, yes, you do. Because in his head, he's not thinking, I don't have any money in my wallet. He's thinking the truth, which is, yes, you do. There's a bank. There's an ATM right there. We have money. Let's do something about this, right? And Clutch said, no, we're not going to do it. And they got their treats, and Danny was still talking. Like, why didn't we help those people? Accusing Colette, like, do not take us a different way home. We're like, well, we're going to walk by those people. You're going to give them some money, right? And eventually, after they left the bakery, Cammie, my now 12-year-old, she just turned 12, took out her wallet, and she had some small bills, and gave them to Danny and said, here, buddy, you can give some money to these folks on the way home. So why is this a story I tell about compassion? First of all, it's just the general sense of, I think our general understanding of what compassion is just to be caring, right? I think that we say compassion, we think of compassion as a general sense of being caring. And Danny has this kind of inborn sensitivity to the needs of others. But the reason I tell this story in particular is because, etymologically speaking, compassion is actually the Latin kind of transliteration of a Greek word, which is the word sympathy. Sympatheia, which is the word we get from sympathy, which means to suffer with someone. Now, the word pathos, which is what passion and compassion and pathy and sympathy comes from, that word doesn't need to mean suffering. It can just mean to feel feelings, like to have a strong reaction, even like desire or any strong emotion would be understood as this kind of passion, but it's to feel with somebody, right? And what I thought is interesting in this situation is just kind of tracking Danny's feelings on this walk through Harvard Square, right? When he sees these folks who are asking for money, he feels strong emotion. It's not the same emotion that they must be feeling, right? It's a different emotion, but he feels it with them. There's like an accompaniment there, and it leads him to have like a little bit of anger, right? Like the emotion he's actually feeling is, Mom, why aren't you doing something about this, right? And then Cammie's response, which we could read as compassionate towards the people who are asking for money, is actually her feeling with Danny, right? She's taking care of him, feeling his kind of anger, his frustration, and responding to him. So just one of the things that's interesting about compassion, I think, is just how difficult or how problematic compassion can be when we assume we know what another person is feeling. Like, that's not feeling with somebody, I don't think. That's like feeling instead of somebody or trying to own their feelings rather than honor them. What's interesting about this story with Danny is that he was feeling with folks, but what he was feeling was entirely his own, and he was taking action based upon his own feelings, not upon what he thought the other people were feeling. So this is why I tell the story, because I think when we think about compassion, we need to think about not feeling instead of others or in place of others or taking responsibility for others' feelings, but paying attention to what other suffering makes us feel and then responding to our own feelings in the best and most loving way.
So I love everything you just said, but I want to focus in the best and most loving way, right? Because I think that is just such a key part of compassion, yep. Right? Is noticing your own feelings in response to someone else's feelings, and then that choicefulness of like, okay, and so what am I going to do with my feelings now?
Right.
Right. Danny could do any number of things with his anger, and he decided to like continue to advocate rather than to lash out in another way.
That's right. That's also true for we grownups who don't have cash in our wallet and walk by these folks as well. Because what's the most loving thing to do in that situation? I mean, just because I'm a person that has worked with people who are unhoused in the past in my own life, like I know what difference $5 makes, right? And I know it doesn't respond to structural racism, but I know that I also know that the most loving thing is not to rationalize to myself that any gift I give would not change any structural problems, right?
Right.
Like there must be some more loving way to respond to the people around me and to a person who is asking for money than to tell myself that I don't need to respond in any direct way, right? And this is why it's hard to walk with Danny through the square, because I know he is going to actually call me to account in some way, right? I do know better than him, but he also knows better than me, because he's actually saying, yeah, maybe I don't know the most loving thing. All I know is that the thing you're doing is not the most loving thing. And what the compassion he feels is let's try to be more loving, right? In what we do for these folks. Okay, Vanessa, you are beginning our 30-second recaps today.
I'm leading the way.
I will count you in. 3, 2, 1, go.
So there's the creepy statue, and then Harry sees Ginny, and he's like, oh, Ginny, please don't be dead. And then Tom Riddle, who's a little fuzzy, is like, oh, she's not dead. She will be. And he's coming into more focus. And then Harry figures out that Tom Riddle is bad news because he takes his wand. And Harry's like, oh, my God, I'm going to fight you. And it turns out that he's Voldemort. And he sets the basilisk on Harry. And Harry is like, no. And the basilisk bites him, and he pulls the thing out, and Fox cries on his ears and he on his arm, and he uses the basilisk fang to stab the diary. It was perfect.
That was very well done.
That was flawless.
That was a compassionate reading because you anticipated my suffering and performed as well as I will in this 30-second recap. You said, you know what? That's rude. Matt's going to fail. I will soften his landing with this 30-second recap.
That's so rude. I thought I did like a B-minus job. I don't think I failed. Okay, 3, 2, 1, go.
So Harry's in the chamber and Ginny is very close to death. And then Tom Riddle's there and Harry's like, Tom, you have to help me. But Tom is not a nice person. And he says, let's talk and I'm going to kill you too. And then Harry gets very angry and he says some magic words of loyalty. And then Fox shows up and also the Sorting Hat. And Tom's like, that's not going to help. But it does help because the Fox basically blinds the basilisk and Harry kills the basilisk. And then he stabs the diary and then Ginny wakes up and they go see Ron and everything's going to be okay.
B-. That was really good.
B-.
No, I think that was better than a B-. Matt, there's a moment right at the beginning of this chapter that confuses me.
Okay.
Which is that Harry comes out the gate assuming good intentions in Tom Riddle.
This
does not strike me as regular Harry behavior. Harry grew up in a house with Dudley and Vernon and Petunia. Harry has had to deal with Draco. He's had to fight Voldemort, Quirrell, Snape. And yet he's so trusting of Tom. I'm wondering what you make of this theory, which is that he's so busy being concerned about Ginny, strategy has sort of gone out the window. That his compassion for Ginny, which might actually be compassion for Ron and the Weasleys, is so complete that he can't see that other people might not be in on it. Or does this not even seem out of character for Harry to you?
I don't know that it's out of character. I think that might be too generous. I think it doesn't need to be either or. It can be both and. I think he is definitely in panic mode. That's why they're down there. And now that he's seen Ginny, why wouldn't someone want to save a dying child, right?
Right.
And he doesn't have any strong reason to believe that Tom Riddle will betray him or has betrayed Ginny, right? And this is where I think that it's maybe not out of character. I think that Harry does not have faith in every wizard. He knows that there are folks like Lucius Malfoy and Draco who should not be trusted, Crabbe and Goyle. But he has faith in Hogwarts, I think. He believes that Hogwarts is a good institution. And the fact that Tom Riddle was given a special reward, like he thinks that the mistake that Hogwarts made was well-intended, just wrong, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that this book is really kind of uncovering is how we've used this metaphor before on the podcast, Vanessa, but that like this idea of wizarding supremacy is actually in the walls of the place. The place was built on this ideal. That's the kind of metaphor of the basilisk, that it's always lurking within the walls, and it was built upon these ideals. And that kind of faith in Hogwarts, right, is exactly what Riddle exploits, because it's easy to accuse the non-pureblood student, Hagrid, right? And it's easy to take advantage, even dip its wizarding bias and say like, well, of course he'll trust me because I'm a good wizard. Hagrid's genealogy is less sure or whatever, less certain, less more suspect. He can be suspected. And I just wonder, like, in that space, in the Chamber of Secrets, all the weight of Hogwarts's institutional kind of authority is saying, yeah, Tom Riddle's a trustworthy person. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think Harry's just inclined to believe it. And you're right, it is a mistake. It's absolutely a mistake. And I think that's part of where his anger comes from.
I actually love the way that this chapter, I mean, even just in those opening sentences, is like wizarding supremacy is in the statues, right? Like the basilisk comes out of the mouth of Salazar Slytherin.
Yep.
And I feel like while we're in this continued conversation about what to do with things like Confederate statues and even, you know, more subtle forms of oppression that are structurally built into our society, physically into our edifices, you know, into our art. I love that this chapter is like, nope, these things are poison. As long as you keep them up, you know, without context, bad things are literally going to come out of the mouth. And like, you're just going to keep perpetuating these cycles. And I find it deeply compelling in this chapter that the walls can do violence, right? If they are saying or representing things that are hurtful to current students, they can absolutely do violence.
Yep.
Which is an argument for creating like a compassionate space.
So I have a example from the chapter that I think might press my definition for my story for more detail, right? Or for more clarity, right? If you remember my definition, I was like, you know, compassion etymologically is just feeling with. And you don't need to feel the same thing as the person who's suffering. Like, you just have to feel with them and respond in some way, right? And I didn't say anything about, like I said, you know, in the most loving way, but like, I didn't specify, like, what are the emotions that stir us to be more loving or more just, right? Because there's an argument that Tom Riddle is feeling with Ginny. He's feeling something. He sees Ginny dying. He sees her suffering, and he feels boredom. Remember, he keeps talking about how boring, all how boring her whining is. And that she comes to him seeking compassion. Like, she comes to him seeking someone who can suffer with her. She wants to write down her sufferings in this diary. And Riddle takes advantage of that by, like, pretending to suffer with her in a particular way. But actually, all he's feeling with her is this feeling of boredom, which she talks about over and over again. Feeling with has to be more than just feeling anything with, right? There is some implication of justice. There is some implication of care, of intending the good for the other implied in the definition, right? Because it's not enough to just be a sociopath and acknowledge another one is feeling something and feel nothing response, right? Because I know maybe Tom Riddle here is sociopathic, but it seems like he is feeling something is boredom, disdain, impatience, right? And those are the wrong things.
Yeah. But here's the thing. This is like, so does compassion matter without action, right? Like, would it matter that Danny gets so upset about this if he didn't then insist on giving people money? Because, like, sometimes I'm bored when people complain, but then I'm nice about it and ask follow-up questions. And so does it matter that I'm bored as long as I'm kind about it?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Vanessa, because, you know, we've talked in this podcast in the past about, like, what's the relationship between what you feel on the inside and what you do on the outside, right? And, like, one of the things we've said over and over again is that, like, impact matters, right? And so, like, let's say you don't feel something deeply, but you go through all the motions of caring for somebody really lovingly, right? I want to call that compassion. And I'm not sure where we draw the line between, like, how much feelings matter and when they need to start giving over into action for us to kind of to recognize them as adequate or moral or just or whatever. I mean, there has to be some action and there can't be no feeling. I'm not sure where the line is.
I mean, I think that Fox might be an interesting place to look at this, right? Like, Fox's tears heal Harry. And in theory, Fox can't cry unless he's like having some sort of feeling, except that we know that people can fake crying, right? Like, can make themselves cry. And maybe Fox, because he knows he has these magical tears, is like able to do it, right? And so the overarching argument upon first reading of Fox's tears healing Harry is that his compassion, his empathy for Harry, his grief for Harry revives Harry. But I think that there could be an argument that it doesn't matter. The tears are healing and Fox is like, I'm going to squeeze these out of myself no matter how I can, no matter what I have to do in order to do it, because they have the magical power.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's, there has to have been compassion at one point, right? So when someone I love is telling me about the frustrations of their day, and on that day I happen to be short-tempered and not really care, because I have cared in the past, right? Yeah. Because I've done the equivalent of like felt that grief and seen that my tears can heal, seen that my follow-up questions mean a lot to the person.
Yeah.
I can almost like rely on my past compassion to teach me how to behave in this moment and be like, okay, this person likes when I go, ah, that's so annoying. Yeah.
And there's like a resolve in you to just sort of like, it doesn't matter what I'm feeling because I care about this person. I am going to behave this way. And which actually makes me think the reading I just offered of Tom Riddle was wrong, I think, because I was saying that what he felt was impatience, right? But actually the word patience, what you're describing to me is patience, right? You're patient with this person, even though you don't really want to hear the story, you're going to be patient with them and go through the motions of showing compassion, showing care. The word patience comes from the same root as compassion and sympathy. To be patient means to feel those feelings, right? And so by definition, when Riddle is impatient and finds her boring, right, that's him just refusing to feel the feelings, refusing to feel the right feelings, right? I mean, it's interesting, though, when he's talking about how he manipulated her, he says, I was patient, I wrote back, I was sympathetic, I was kind. I mean, he's naming behaviors there, not feelings. Like he's saying, right. I went through the motions in order to make Ginny feel safe. The difference there between your example and Tom Riddle here really is intention, because you are going through the emotions in order to actually provide care for the person so they will feel cared for and loved, so that they will be cared for and loved, right? Whereas Tom Riddle is going through the motions so that Ginny will feel cared for and loved, so that he can exploit her and take advantage of her,
right?
Which is evil, right?
Right.
And not compassionate for that reason.
Matt, another moment where I'm like, I'm not sure compassion fits into this, what I think it's so interesting, is the moment where Harry says to Riddle, I don't know how you lost your power, but I know that I survived because my mother sacrificed herself for me. And then Riddle goes, there's nothing special about you after all. Yeah. And the satisfaction that he feels in that moment, I recognized that feeling in myself of seeing behind the curtain and realizing that something that seemed completely complex and opaque and unachievable suddenly becomes clear. Mm-hmm. And I just always like to pay attention to the moments in which I really identify with Voldemort or Tom Riddle. And this was one. Maybe that's it. It's my compassion for Tom Riddle, that relief of looking at someone who you feel competitive with and being like, oh, we're the same.
I read that moment differently. I think Tom's lying.
Oh, say more.
Because Harry is special. He had somebody who loved him that much, which is not what Tom Riddle had. He has to say it's not special, because that would mean that he is not special, because no one loved him that much. No one was there for him to do that. I mean, this is what we hear in this story, right? Where Tom talks about his muggle dad who abandoned his mother because she was a witch, right? Like, there is this deep, deep emotional wound inside Tom Riddle. Like, the psychology of Voldemort comes out in this scene. And that, I mean, the terrifying thing, I think, for Riddle, and maybe for all of us, is that that kind of protective love is one that someone has to give to you, right? What Voldemort... Yeah. Voldemort did not have it from his family. And so he's trying to give it to himself. He's trying to give these protective charms to himself, and spends all his energy and all the time before this and all the books after this trying to figure out ways that he can depend upon no one else to give himself that kind of protective charm. And Harry just was the lucky kid whose parents loved him and gave him that charm because they gave it to him for no other reason than that they loved him. And that charm not only protected him in that moment, it also kind of made him the kind of kid that is going to be able to lean upon others and depend upon others throughout the rest of these series of books, which continues to be the protective charm that supports him and saves him. So when I say that Tom Riddle's lying, I think he believes it when he says it. I think he says, you're not special, because you don't have any special magic. It's just love, right?
Yeah.
But Voldemort also knows that love is the one thing he couldn't give himself, or that that people weren't there to give him, and that is why he can't actually achieve the kind of protection Harry has. And so he needs it to be true when he says it, even as much as he believes it's true.
Oh, I find that very compelling. And I mean, and we see evidence of this kind of continued love for Harry. It occurred to me while reading this chapter how loving Ginny was for going and stealing the diary back, right? Like, that's so brave and so self-sacrificing in order to protect Harry, right? Like, people are still doing these things for him. Yep. And also just, like, the beauty and vulnerability of yelling, like, someone help, don't leave me, don't leave me alone, right? Like, even when it's, you know, as Voldemort says, a songbird in a hat. Yep. Harry is just so relieved that something showed up for him and that he's not alone. That feeling is making him feel buoyed again and again and again.
And that's why, like, the width of feeling with or suffering with, the compassion, that prefix, is so essential. There's something about company. There's something about being in this together that makes such a difference.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Feel about Ron's move at the end? Like, Ginny has just survived and Ron's like, let's tease you about your crush on Harry. Like, Ron is like helping Ginny through the wall. He's so relieved that she's alive. He's so relieved that she's alive. And then,
well, I think that Ron doesn't know. I mean, Ron doesn't know the state she was in. By the time she gets to the wall, perhaps if he had seen her nearly dead on the ground, he might not have responded the same way. But I could also, isn't this just like siblings? Like, the way you show affection to someone, if it's a habit, in the moment of crisis, will often still be the way you show affection to that person, even if it's not appropriate to the moment. Does that make sense? Like, I feel like I've had this with folks.
I guess I do it to you. It's just not compassionate. That's my question. Is it compassionate? Feeling with someone and like not knowing what to do with that feeling and so making a dumb joke?
I think it kind of is. The habitual way I show affection for you is this way, and I want to show it to you now, and this is the tool I have. There's this really heartbreaking episode of This American Life, which takes place in northern Japan in one of the communities that was hit by the tsunami several years ago. And this guy put up a telephone booth in his backyard, and the telephone booth is not connected to anything. The phone inside the telephone booth is not connected to anything. It's got no wires or anything, but there is a recording device in there, and people come in there and like make fake phone calls, not fake phone calls, real phone calls to dead loved ones who died in the tsunami. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, in the Japanese language, in Japanese custom, it's just not, you don't say I love you to people. There are different words you use. The word I, which is love, you don't actually say Aishiteru, which means I love you, is not anything you would ever say to people. Even in your close family, there are different phrases that you use to express affection. And the recordings from this phone booth are heartbreaking, because it'll be like old men talking to their wives who were carried out to sea, and they'll just be saying things like, are you warm enough? Make sure you have a coat wherever you are, because it might be cold. Right? Like the way you have always shown affection to the person is going to be the way you show affection to them when given the opportunity to do so again. And I just feel like these brothers tease Ginny.
Yeah.
Right or wrong, they tease Ginny. When Ginny comes back, he's so relieved. And just the words he has for her are the words he always has for her to show affection, right? Even if they're not the most fitting or most appropriate. What I'd like to think is that because Ginny's in that system, that she feels some love from Ron when that comes. But who knows?
Yeah, I think it just really hit me this time, because in reading the chapter, I noticed how one of the things that she complained to Tom about was how much her brothers tease her.
Oh,
and so
that's
the teasing
right.
was, right? Like, teasing is one of the reasons that she felt isolated.
You're
and
right.
I think, I wonder if this experience makes her rethink that. We see her really horsing around with Fred and George later.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's some sort of breakthrough of, you know, feeling love through teasing. But we do know that, like, it's one of the things that made her feel isolated, and it's the burst thing she hears from a family member when she gets out. I'm not judging Ron. I'm just questioning my own.
I think you're right.
Teasing strategies.
No, yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because I'd forgotten about that line. But you're right. I think the chances that it lands the right way for her are pretty slim right now that you said that. You talked about her horsing around with the boys later. And there is some, I mean, patron saint of survivors, right? There's something about her having survived worse than any of these other brothers, that what she was teased for was being the smallest, being the youngest, being least ready for Hogwarts, whatever. And now she's got something that none of them can, like, she's been to the depths of the school, and she's seen things, and she's been places, and she knows she's a survivor, and she knows, I feel like, her interactions with her brothers and with every wizard from now on in the series, there is a strength and a resilience that's really clear in her.
Yeah.
So there's one last thing I wanted to talk about, and it's actually revisiting something we were talking about before, which was Dippet's failure to actually understand what was going on in the school and the way Tom takes advantage of Hogwarts's kind of ingrained wizarding bias and wizarding supremacy to get Hagrid expelled and also keep access for himself to the Chamber of Secrets, which is around this question of compassion, because one of the things I was thinking was that in that moment, when Dippet is confronted with Tom Riddle and Hagrid, it's so much easier, one would expect, for Dippet to feel with Tom, who's a wizard, right, than to feel with the half-giant, half-wizard, right? Like, it's easier to be compassionate towards the people who are more like us, which is exactly what Tom Riddle knew, which is exactly why he knew he could get the half-giant expelled, because just naturally, instinctively, intuitively, Dippet would be less compassionate, would less inclined to feel with or be sympathetic to a person who's unlike himself. And that's what Riddle used to frame Hagrid. And so it's just a reminder to all of us, right, to know that this is just a natural tendency, that we always feel more compassion. We always feel more easily with the folks who look like us, who we identify with.
Right.
And usually the folks we most need to feel compassion for are the ones who are least like us, who we least identify with. And so it's just another kind of call from the text to do better and to try to extend the reach of our feeling to those with whom we have less affinity.
Yeah. I mean, and that's how power maintains itself, right?
Right. Compassion has to have some relation to justice. Otherwise, it's only feeling with.
Right.
I mean, this actually suggests that relationship to justice is necessary. Like, there is no compassion without some sense of justice, because otherwise you're only feeling with people who are easy to feel with. And justice means feeling with people who are different, with whom it doesn't come as easily or naturally by virtue of shared identity or affinity.
So, Matt, I picked a sentence at random for us to do parties with, and the sentence is, "I bet Dumbledore saw right through you," said Harry, his teeth gritted. Okay, so step one is intended meaning. And so what is the intended meaning of the sentence? "I bet Dumbledore saw right through you," said Harry, his teeth gritted.
It's a fact. I bet Dumbledore saw right through you. I think this is true. I think that Harry does believe that Dumbledore saw through Tom Riddle. And I think Harry's probably at least partly right about that. But I think in terms of intention, I think Harry is saying this not just to say a true statement to Tom Riddle. I think his intention here is to irritate or needle or vex Tom, to frustrate and to unsettle Tom by talking about Dumbledore and talking about how Dumbledore is superior to him. So the literal meaning is, here's a true statement, Dumbledore saw right through you. The meaning behind that statement is, I want you to feel some discomfort. What do you think?
I completely agree.
Okay.
He's like, nobody was impressed by you. And he's trying to remind Tom that Dumbledore is still better than him.
The only one that matters wasn't impressed by you. So you may have tricked everybody else, but this one you didn't trick. Yeah.
Yeah. Dumbledore always knew.
Yep.
So step two is remes, where we trace a word throughout the books. So, Matt, what word do you think that we should use?
Well, the word teeth really stands out to me in this.
Yeah.
In this sentence.
Great. Well, that makes sense. There is a tooth in this chapter. There's a basilisk fang, which I would argue is a kind of tooth.
There is.
And it nearly kills Harry, but then it also kind of kills Tom Riddle. It kills a Horcrux. And then that same basilisk tooth, I'm just going to keep calling it a tooth, is used in book 7 to destroy Horcruxes.
That's right.
We also know that Hermione shortens her teeth.
She sure does.
Draco elongates her teeth. Snape makes fun of her teeth. And then Hermione shortens her teeth. Also, her parents are dentists.
Mm-hmm. Like, how literal do we have to track the word tooth? Because lots of people get bit, right?
Yeah.
Lots of people get bit in the books.
Greyback gets, his teeth get described. And Lupin absolutely gets bit.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. So, right, teeth, I mean, teeth are able to cause violence or to help you nourish yourself, right?
That's right. Or to indicate, I mean, we could also think about all the times people smile at one another in this book, right? And show their teeth to each other.
Yeah. Okay, Matt, now we are doing Drosh, where we reflect on what lesson we would want to discuss if this was the text that we were preaching on. "I bet Dumbledore saw right through you," said Harry, his teeth gritted.
I think I would want to preach upon what it means to see another, to recognize another, and to see through another, to see another, right? Because part of what Harry's talking about is sort of like seeing through the facade of your goodness into the kind of the evil underneath. But what we also learn in this chapter is that an even deeper layer is that there is this kind of deep emotional traumatic wound at the source of Tom Riddle's pain. And that's also a version of seeing through that we might call ourselves to when we do the kinds of things that we were talking about before, when we try to have more compassion, to try to feel with those who are least like us. Often that includes people with whom we're at odds or people with whom we're angry, like trying to see through not as an exposure of all the things that are wrong with them, but actually trying to see them completely and as generously and as wholly as we might see ourselves or those that we do have affinities for. So I think that's what I would probably want to preach about. What would you want to preach about, Vanessa?
I think I would want to preach on quality downtime. Like, this is something that Tom Riddle should have reflected on. I think reflecting and looking back at, like, oh, that person knew that then, and like sort of thinking back on your younger self is a really helpful move. Like, I think we should be reflecting on our past in a significant way. And one of the things that I know that I feel like I don't have access to a lot is time that is totally unaccounted for, like just laying on the floor and letting my brain do some wandering or staring out a window. Or like, one of the problems with Tom Riddle is that he has like no reflection instinct. He's always going forward. He's always about consuming and conquering and, you know, and the next thing. And I think that that's one of the ways that we turn ourselves into instruments rather than letting ourselves be fully human. Mm-hmm. So I think I would preach about that, trying to cultivate a practice of downtime.
That's great. That's just hanging out down in the Chamber of Secrets. Just relaxing.
Yeah. Chilling out.
Yep.
So Matt, it's your favorite part. It's the sode, where we see if a new secret emerges to us. "I bet Dumbledore saw right through you," said Harry, his teeth gritted. The secret that emerges to me is that Dumbledore, through seeing right through Tom, really missed an opportunity. If Dumbledore, rather than seeing through Tom, had really tried to connect with Tom, that Dumbledore could have been the person who loved Tom. By seeing through Tom, he could have been the person who's like, "I love you anyway." And I think that it could be why Dumbledore is so committed to this. I think that Dumbledore really fails as a teacher to Tom Riddle. And like, I don't think we should see through children, right? I think we should like see through their nonsense to like get to their heart. But like, I think that as adults, it's our responsibility to try to not see through children, but really see them.
So I think here's my secret. I think I actually got to a secret from this.
Oh my God.
I think it's that Harry sees through Tom this early on. I think by the final scene of book 7, he sees through Tom, right? But even this early in book 2, he already knows all this backstory, all this history he's going to learn later and be revealed to him by Dumbledore in book 6 and book 7 or whatever. Actually, he basically knows the broad outlines of it in book 2 just from this quick encounter. And so what he's actually saying when he says, "I bet Dumbledore saw right through you," what he's actually saying is, "I see right through you, and I actually know what's going on.
You're just a scared little boy."
Yep. So I think there's a secret.
Look at you. You did it, Matt.
Great.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
It's now time for our voicemail. This week's voicemail is from Laura.
Hi, Vanessa, Matt, and everyone on your team. My name is Laura. I'm 21 and I'm from Germany. I love listening to your podcast because it makes me think about the books in a new perspective. Like when I was listening to your episode in book 2 about narcissism. And in this episode, you're talking about the mandrakes and how Professor Sprout and his students care for them just enough to ultimately sacrifice them to heal all the petrified students. And they're basically described as these human babies. And that made me think about Harry. Ultimately, Harry has to sacrifice himself in book 7 and he has to die. Dumbledore knows this. Dumbledore cares throughout all the books for Harry, but just for the right amount. Like, Harry has to live with the Dursleys. Dumbledore obviously knows to some extent that the Dursleys are not a loving family or a home to Harry, but they still are enough of a family to him that the protective magic works, and so Harry has to live there. And even when Harry's in Hogwarts, Dumbledore always teaches Harry enough to ultimately survive Voldemort and to defeat Voldemort, but never teaches him all the details and all of his suspicions. And that just made me think how there maybe is a parallel between the Mandrakes and Harry, because the people surrounding them obviously care for them just enough, and in the end, they're sacrificed. And it made me wonder if those people just care for Mandrakes and Harry because of their own selfish reasons and not because they're a creature that is worth its own. Thank you for everything on the podcast. Bye.
Thank you, Laura, for this voice memo. You've drawn a really interesting parallel between the way these Mandrakes are treated and exactly the reason why Harry gets so angry, I think, in book 7, because he feels like he's been a pawn in Dumbledore's plan from the beginning. And putting those two examples side by side really raises all the problematic moral questions of asking people to sacrifice themselves. I think there is one difference, which is hope, right? And I don't think it's a sufficient difference. I think that your critique and the worries that you give rise to in your voice memo stand, even if there is the difference of hope. But We know from the King's Cross encounter in Book 7 that although Dumbledore knows that Harry has to be willing to die, he hopes that he will not have to remain dead, right? Like there's a scene where he's talking to Harry and Dumbledore is really happy because he suggests, like, I had hoped that we would arrive at this place and you would have the chance to go back. All I knew is that you had to be willing to die, but I hope that there would be this kind of lingering protective charm that would allow you to escape the permanence of death. And that hope actually does turn out in the end. And so I think the fact that he has that hope makes us think that maybe Dumbledore is not quite as callous as Professor Sprout and Madame Pomfrey in the way that they slaughter the mandrakes. That Dumbledore thinks this is a necessary thing, but he hopes it's not a permanent thing, or he hopes that there's some way out of it. But again, even if that, all that's true, the moral problem you raise stands, and the comparison brings it into greater light. So thank you, Laura.
It's now time for us to remember members of our community who have been lost. Chrissy Scanlon, who is 91 and a mother of two. Brant Ventimiglia, who is 40, a musician, and never met a stranger. Joyce Espenson, who is 89, a beloved grandmother, teacher, world traveler, and avid Chicago Cubs fan. Brenda, who is a loving aunt and a ferocious hugger. Lisa Kohler, who is 46, a teacher, friend, and trivia wizard. And Norman Adama, who is 64, a craftsman and a grandfather of 17. May their memories be a blessing.
Vanessa, who would you like to bless this week?
I'm going to bless our darling Ginny. I'm sure I blessed her last time, but I mean, this is a great trauma that she is going through. And I think I just want to use this opportunity to bless all victims, right? Ginny didn't do anything wrong to deserve this. She wasn't irresponsible in any way. She's going to be a little bit victim blamed in the next chapter. And I just want to say, like, this really isn't her fault. This was a bad man exploiting her. And so I would just like to offer a blessing to Ginny and to anyone out there who has been exploited and say that it really, really isn't your fault. Matt, what about you?
Vanessa, I would like to bless Harry. And there are all kinds of reasons to bless Harry in this chapter, some of which we talked about during our theme conversation. But I want to bless him from one particular moment, which is at the end of the chapter when he refrains from revealing to Ron in that moment of the siblings' reunion that Ginny was the one who opened the Chamber of Secrets. He's just like, you know what? Now's not the time. Let's let them have this moment where Ron teases her. Let's let them have this moment. This information will all come out. It's actually not as important right now. It wasn't her fault, right? Like, he knows that that's not the most important thing, and that if he says it now, it will be misinterpreted, misconstrued, the importance will be misplaced, whatever, and just leaves it for later. And I think that's great and deserves a blessing.
Well, Matt, next week we're going to be finishing the book, Chapter 18, Dobby's Reward, and we always end on the theme of love. So I will tell a story on that theme.
Great. Can't wait.
Love that theme. Just a few reminders before we give our thanks. We have a Winnie the Pooh virtual pilgrimage coming up and a Pride and Prejudice in-person pilgrimage coming up. You can find out more at readingandwalkingwith.com.
Harry Potter and the Sacred Text is a Not Sorry production, and Not Sorry Productions is a feminist production company. Our executive producer is Ariana Nettleman. We are edited and produced by AJ Yaramas. Our engineer is Erica Wong. Our music is by Ivan Paisau and Nick Bull, and we are distributed by Acast.
This week, we'd like to thank Laura for their voicemail, Lara Glass, Julia Argy, Gabby Iori, Nikki Zoltan, Casper Terkyle, Stephanie Paulsell, and everyone who sent in the names of their loved ones. And so it, right, like, which is an argument for creating like a compassionate space. Hufflepuff University, everyone. I'll teach the lot is the motto.